Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Mike Florio.
Let's bring in Mike Florio here. Joins us on the program.
NBC Sports.
All right, Florio, I know you're probably busy.
Pro Football Talk.
Starts the day, he ends the day with Pro Football Talk. He is Mike Florio.
We have learned that an unvaccinated Aaron Rodgers has tested positive for COVID. Your thoughts?
Well, you know what? He's a big, fat liar.
I wouldn't listen to some of those people out there, especially guys like Mike Florio.
Go to hell with your big brain, ladies and gentlemen. Pro Football Talk's Mike Florio.
Mike Florio with Bernstein and Rahimi.
How are you, Mike?
On the Score.
Wednesdays at 10, we talk football with Mike Florio. He's on Twitter at Pro Football Talk, the creator of Pro Football Talk, and he of NBC joins us on the Score Hotline, presented by Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book. Hello, Mike. What's happening?
Hey, how's it going today?
Hello, hello. And I noticed on Pro Football Talk that a story was published hearing from Jalen Johnson, and the Bears should throw Kyler Gordon and Jaquan Brisker into the fire. What is your impression of Gordon and Brisker? Because to me, when they were drafted, Mike, I thought that they were players who could make a difference on this team immediately, perhaps start in week one.
Well, if you're going to get rid of all your veteran talent, you better hope that you can plug your draft picks in and get them to play. So somebody's got to take the reps. And, you know, the idea of putting guys on ice indefinitely, that has kind of fallen out of favor in the NFL in recent years. We do see some guys who develop more quietly, but if you're stepping into a situation where a lot of the veteran players with name recognition aren't going to be there, you better hope that the new players you bring in via the draft are ready to go.
Something we've discussed regarding the Bears at length that had a little more fuel added to the fire was the extent to which the Bears are helping support Justin Fields in a critical year, trying to prove himself on the field and for a new coaching and managerial regime. Mike Tanier of Football Outsiders wrote a kind of a wild, frankly, overwritten, very ornate story about what the Bears are not doing for him, and used a lot of heavy terminology about just talking about how they're abandonment of him. I thought it was a little much, and I understood the idea of, hey, if he's great, he can be great, and we don't know how they're evaluating him and his and how it's all coming together, but it seems like we're divided into camps now, as is so common in our in reductive as we are, to say either the get Justin Fields more help, you're abandoning him, or things will be fine. And I guess I'm closer to the latter than the former. What's right in this?
Well, the key is this. It's not a matter of how they're currently evaluating him. The question is, what did the current regime think of Justin Fields in the run-up to the 2021 draft? What did Ryan Poles think of Justin Fields when he evaluated him in comparison to other quarterbacks in the draft class and other quarterbacks in the league? What did Matt Eberflus think of Justin Fields? That's all relevant to the broader dynamic of whether they're all in. And they're not going to interview for the job saying, you know, the first thing we'd like to do is get a different quarterback, because those guys you fired because they weren't very good at their jobs in your assessment, That not being very good at their jobs included the quarterback that they traded up to get, because we don't think he's very good. They're not going to say that. They got to try to make it work, at least in the short term. But that's why I keep looking at what they're putting around him or not putting around him. And there's a school of thought that he's good enough that he can overcome that. But come on, you got to have some talent around you in order to be the best you can be. And if the team struggles, what's the narrative going to be? We've talked about this before. The narrative is going to be Justin Fields must not be very good. And that lays the foundation to move on from Justin Fields. So you're in that window, first 3 years of a quarterback's career, where if you think you have a great young quarterback, you load up the cannon around him with free agents, high-priced, spend money. Then, because later you're going to be spending money on the quarterback if you sign into a second contract. It's just a weird vibe right now with the Bears because it feels like they're in a full-blown rebuild, and usually you rebuild in search of a quarterback. You've already got your quarterback, at least in the estimation of the old regime. From the new regime's perspective, all we can do is look at the moves they're making and what support they are or aren't giving to Justin Fields, and it's justifiable. It may not be accurate, but reasonable minds can differ on whether or not they are doing enough to help him and whether or not they're eventually going to be looking for their guy. They don't want the guy that the old regime found. They want their own guy. The old regime got fired. We want our own guy. I'm not saying that that's how they feel, but I can understand if that's how they feel.
Well, if you look at the defensive side of it, we know that they prioritized those first two picks specifically for defensive needs in the draft. However, they also traded Khalil Mack. We don't know what the status of Robert Quinn is on the team moving forward. He certainly proved his worth last year, but that contract is what it is. So you could also say that they're retooling on that side or rebuilding, whatever word you want to use, in a way that's deconstructive too. There's no real direction at all, it seems like, right now, other than just getting some pieces to fit open spots rather than get a big name or somebody who gives you a real direction of what this team is doing.
And you have to pay attention to defense. Look, the Packers spent their two first-round picks on defense, even though they have needs on offense. The Chiefs did the same thing. You still got to have a defense out on the field. So it just feels like the Bears have a lot more to address than any team can manage to address in one offseason. And it feels like, even though you'd ideally like to build up while you tear down, it just feels like there's more tearing down than building up. And again, you have faith in your rookies that they can come in and make a difference, and maybe they can. You have faith in the fact that right now the NFC isn't maybe as competitive at the top as the AFC is. You got a couple of good teams that are going to probably rule the day in the conference, but you know, the Bears can be competitive with the Vikings and the Lions just because the Vikings and the Lions aren't very good right now. We don't know what they're going to be. So it's going to make for an interesting scrum. The AFC, there's too many good teams and not enough playoff spots. The NFC, where are all the good teams? It opens the door for a team that we're not sure about to get their act together, improve on the fly. We see that all the time. Teams get better and teams get worse between September and January. That's an opportunity for the Bears. Once it starts moving, can they make the improvements necessary to get themselves better between week 1 and week 18?
And you mentioned the Vikings, and I saw the news about Demetrius Washington being hired as vice president of football operations and Kwesi Adofo-Mensah continuing to add even to his front office after the draft. We keep an eye on him because he was available here, possibly. He goes to a division rival. What do you make of that hire and the front office that they're putting together?
Well, it's all to be determined. We don't know how it's going to play out. And one of the concerns I have with the Vikings generally, and this is something that I've said many times as it relates to the Dolphins, when ownership doesn't reside in the city where the team is, when ownership isn't showing up every day to make sure that everything is under control, it's very critical that there be the right dynamic between front office and coaching staff. And it imploded last year between Rick Spielman, the GM, and Mike Zimmer, the head coach. And Kwesi Adofo-Mensah, I think, was really interested in Jim Harbaugh, but the idea that there isn't ownership there to check Jim Harbaugh to the extent that he needs to be checked, I think that may have caused them to go in the other direction toward Kevin O'Connell. So we'll see. We'll see. And, hey, Ryan Poles was on the Vikings list, but the Bears got him to not get on the plane. So there's going to be some interesting apples-to-apples comparisons about what kind of a team they put together in Minnesota and some daring decisions by Kwesi Adofo-Mensah to trade down with the Lions so they could get Jameson Williams, a receiver that they need, and then trading down in round two with the Packers so they could get the receiver they really wanted in Christian Watson. That could come back and haunt the Vikings in two different ways by those decisions to move back.
You wrote something last night that had me asking some questions, and I am never comfortable going down this path where that would lead to conspiracy theorizations. But when you talk about the Deshaun Watson decision still in abeyance and how the NFL has seven sports betting partners that can't conduct business the way they want until this decision is made, it made me wonder about the dialogue that occurs, if it occurs, where and how. Are all of the sports betting partners of the NFL represented by an umbrella group? Are they all treated just like other sponsorship partners and business partners? Who has conversations or who could have conversations with important people in the NFL about these things? And what is okay in a way to conduct business and what is not?
Well, it's still a new frontier. I know from the broadcasting standpoint, each network that is a broadcast partner has its own pipeline to the league office, and sometimes you get satisfaction and sometimes you don't. But with the sports betting, you've got different tiers. You've got the ones who are paying the biggest money, the initial ones that try exclusive. It's not just exclusive to one, it's exclusive to three. It's tri-exclusive, FanDuel and DraftKings, and I can't remember who the third one was. Points bet's on the second tier, okay, with the other four that got tacked on. You got seven. Yeah, usually they have one partner for, you know, beer and candy bar and pizza. They got seven for one industry, which is sports betting. But I think they would all say the same thing. We just want to be able to put the Browns on the board. The Browns are off the board when it comes to whether or not they will or won't make the playoffs. The Browns are off the board on whether or not they'll win more or less games than whatever we're going to peg their number to be. We want to put them on the board. We want to take action on these teams, all of the teams, not 31 teams, on 32. And it's not a huge dollar item, but still, there's a different incentive there than ever existed before. The urgency on behalf of these people who are paying the NFL good money collectively, very good money collectively. They made $270 million from their gambling partnerships last year, and they project to make $1 billion a year by the end of the decade. Those folks want to be able to put the Browns on the board. So let's figure this out. And that's just a separate concern from the more basic notion of how much time do you really need to make a decision about what Deshaun Watson's status is for 2022. And the fact that they're meeting with him this week, it tells me they recognize with everything they're going to need to do, all the boxes that need to be checked, the decisions that need to be made, the process that is in place, and it's a new procedure that was adopted in 2020, they're going to need every bit of the summer months to get this done. So it could be that the Friday before Memorial Day weekend, one of the classic bad news dumps, that could be when we find out the suspension that the NFL is proposing for Deshaun Watson. And then by Labor Day, we find out whether or not he's ultimately going to serve that suspension in whole or in part.
The courts are going to tell a lot of truths about the NFL, whether it's the news we got about Deshaun Watson and the deposition about one of the therapists saying that she ended with it crying, and you get that gory detail, which just tells you a little bit more about the severity of what that case is faced with. And then also you have the news, of course, surrounding the Commanders. And then additionally, there's news coming out about St. Louis. What are your big takeaways just from the courts, even this week, when it comes to some of the things that we're hearing about what's being revealed, especially that Rams and NFL lying about the potential move and how that shook out too?
It's amazing that you bring it up. You know, I do a bunch of radio spots throughout the course of the week, and nobody outside of St. Louis is talking about the documents that the St. Louis Post-Dispatch doggedly secured from that litigation. The NFL fought for 5 years to try to pigeonhole that dispute into arbitration. We see that all the time. That's the NFL's default move. Secret rigged kangaroo court of Roger Goodell is the ideal destination because you keep all this stuff from coming out. Those documents show, plain and simple, that the NFL knew that Stan Kroenke bought land in Inglewood, California, at the site of the former Hollywood Park racetrack with the specific intent to build a stadium there, and they lied about it. and they kept lying about it until Kroenke was ready to tell the world. Now, why'd they lie about it? Because they were still playing games in St. Louis, and they wanted the fans to still show up. They wanted them to buy tickets and show up at games and buy overpriced crap. That's why they lied to them. And it's amazing to see it all laid out there. And it's amazing that it took 3 days, 3 business days this week. We wrote a bunch of stories over the weekend about what those documents revealed, courtesy of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. We wrote something about it yesterday. Nobody cares. And I don't get it. How is it not? And maybe it's just we just accept the fact that they're going to lie, that when we catch them in a bald-faced lie, we just kind of shrug and say, you know, tell me something I didn't know.
Well, that's why I found it interesting, was because that is important to not just St. Louis, but it also makes me ask, why isn't anybody in San Diego asking about this in the Chargers move?
Well, they blew their window. There was some noise made a few months back about a guy who used to be, I think, a member of city council, used to be in a position of influence, and they didn't sue when the window was open. I think they blew their statute of limitations. They could have tried something like that. I know Oakland's doing something. It's a different argument, I think. But what the Rams were able to do was use the language of the NFL's relocation policy against it in a very aggressive way and lay the foundation for a $790 million settlement that Stan Kroenke is still trying to pawn off on his partners and not honor his agreement to be responsible for whatever the fallout was of his move. It's still high drama among the oligarchs as to who's going to pay that $790 million. But I know a lot of the owners think, hey, Stan, this is your obligation. This is your consequence that you need to accept.
Well, while I'm here, Stan Kroenke is also starting to receive a lot of fire for the fact that altitude is not distributed in Denver and hasn't been for years. So I'm very curious to see how all of this plays out, because to me, when people start digging, it might be over in the courts, but the court of public opinion might have some sway. So I appreciate you going down that rabbit hole.
Well, the key is the things that are made available to the media and the fans via a court of law help shape the court of public opinion, which is why the NFL's knee-jerk reaction is always, always, always get this case the hell out of court, because that's less stuff that people can read and examine and connect the dots on what we're really up to.
Is that public is that's private arbitration, which means even a FOIA request wouldn't work there, right?
Can't touch it. It's gone. It's all private. It's all secret. It's all now, you know, if you wanted to, you could leak some information. You could try to do it that way. But think of the Colin Kaepernick arbitration. His case necessarily fell under the collective bargaining agreement and arbitration procedures there. There was very little that was leaked. There would be hardly anything if John Gruden's case ends up in the court of Roger Goodell. We're not going to know anything about it. It's going to be very limited discovery. They're going to make it impossible for him, virtually impossible for him, to get what he needs to prove his case. That's how it works. It's these cases that are playing out in open court. Look at the Watson case. The transcripts aren't subject to any type of protective order. No matter what is covered in those depositions, the lawyers can turn around and hand the USA Today or anyone else the transcript, like Tony Busby, who represents the 22 women, did with Ashley Solis's transcript from the case, or from her case, the transcript of Deshaun Watson, and it's open season. That's the difference. It's public if it's in a court of law, but when it's in arbitration, the NFL does a much better job of keeping all of us from seeing what it is that came to light.
And here you thought by founding Pro Football Talk, you could stop being a lawyer, and little did you know that eventually you couldn't.
I remember when I started in this business with absolutely no training or education in journalism, and it showed and still does. I felt horribly inadequate, and a couple of years in, I thought, my God, I would feel even more inadequate if I hadn't practiced law, because it's always something, and it seems like it's really ramped up over the course of the last year, and it seems like it's getting worse, not better, for the NFL.
How's the book doing?
I think it's doing all right. I mean, you know, Father Day's coming up. We keep trying to sell it. I've mentioned this to you before. I've learned a lot about the publishing industry, some good, some bad. Who gets the money? Who doesn't get the money? Who's responsible for the promotion of the book? Who's not responsible for the promotion of the book? So it's been quite an education into an area of commerce that is – and the other thing, too, not a lot of people read books anymore. Shocker. I don't know if they ever did. But we're very far removed from the days of people sitting around with a candle lit at night reading a book because there wasn't anything else to do. It's hard to get people to read books.
Well, Playmaker sounds like an excellent beach read to me, Mike. So we'll take it.
Well, I appreciate that. Hopefully plenty of other people will agree.
Mike Florio, thank you as always.
Thanks. See you.
Thanks, Mike.
That's Mike Florio. Let's talk some Cubs next. We went last night to the Cubs game, had some terrific seats, had some lovely conversations, and a lot of fun going on in that game. Some baseball games aren't so fun, but watching Dan Vogelbach, you know, get into it right in front of us with Wilson Contreras, I didn't exactly see quite what happened. I had to go back and watch it, but watching them come running out of the bullpens, here they come, the doors open and they're unleashed, open the torpedo doors, and whoosh, out come the relievers. Who do I need to push and slap right now? And then cooler heads prevail and everybody goes back.
You pulled a Ranji.
What's that?
You left the game before the magical moment happened.
It was time. I did. We missed the home run, but we did get to see a history-making MLB debut of another kind from a pitcher and watch his whole family going crazy for him. And it was a lot of fun. And just seeing Danny Vogelbach up close and personal is a thing. Baseball players aren't supposed to look like that anymore, and the fact that he does is great.
You know, I was trying to go for a dramatic tease to end the segment, but sometimes I just don't hit.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
Dan Bernstein and Layla Rahimi on Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Sutsugo will hit a high fly ball in the shallow right. This is going to be playable for Suzuki. Tagging a third, Vogelbach. He's going to try to score. Here comes the throw to the plate. The slide. He is going to be out at the plate. Out at the plate. A great throw.
Another win for the Cubs.
The little things. This is OT mad, everybody. OT Genesis, everybody mad. It's the little things. I just like requesting music.
Feel free. Have at it. That's what he's here for. That's Mike Rankin. All things to all people. Oh, and Brandon Fryer, of course. Hi. Sorry.
Brandon Fryer is the one who originated this return cut. Just giving credit where it's due, Brandon.
So the Cubs have won four in a row. They have won, is it 6 of 8?
6 of 8. 2 series, 3, potentially. You realize that series they won against San Diego is the first one they had won series since opening day?
Yeah.
Or opening week, whatever you want to call that. The opening series. The Department of the Redundancy Department.
And if you want to beat up on a bad team, go ahead and do it. The fact is, they have outscored the Pirates, 49-9 in 8 games, and their record is 4-4.
But that's because of the 21-0 ridiculousness.
Sure.
Either way, it's nice to see them putting quality baseball together. And I really do think it started with that performance we saw out of Kyle Hendricks in San Diego. I still am a baseball meatball in that I believe starting pitching sets the tone. It's why I'm obsessed with it all the time. But things have really gone in a good way for them since overall. To take that series from San Diego and then to follow it up with the second 2 of 3 against the Diamondbacks is significant.
And where does Dan Vogelbach's triple rank in the all-time list of big guy triples? And by the way, his official weight, that's his junior high weight.
What's it say? Now you got me curious.
They had him at like, it's like 280 or something like that. No way. And he doesn't run badly.
It's worse than that.
What?
What you said is listed, what you think is 280?
What is it?
Listed is 250.
Oh, come on!
And I'm 5'7".
Oh, please! No, he's 3 spins. And
let's also talk about Rowdy Tellez's listed weight at 255.
They were teammates. But the fact that on that triple, that was a classic, you know, Ian was in between on that one because that was a classic Wrigley, I'm going back. I think the wall is here because I see the wall, but he was right at the bend of the wall as he jumped back, anticipated he's going to literally hit a brick wall. But he didn't know he was that close to the well, so it goes over his head. And he was just on Monday talking about how he's improved his defense by understanding what he doesn't do well. He said he's much better going in on balls than he is going back on balls. So it's changed his positioning. And there it was. You saw it. You kind of saw it coming. You kind of saw it in between. And off goes Vogelbach. And you just knew it. And the moment he goes tearing around second base and he's huffing and puffing, his face is red like a strawberry.
Confidence send there.
Yeah, get him moving. You can see where that ball's rattling around. But like that guy, a 300-pounder with a triple to left field in Wrigley, you don't see a lot of those.
I enjoy the joy with which you are describing this. The dust up with Wilson Contreras, I think it was incidental on Wilson's part. He tapped him on the back to say, are you okay? And then Vogelbach had an outburst.
Yeah, he responded as if, hey, sorry, everything cool.
He's also a former Brewer. So I feel like there's something to that as well. But maybe he's just frustrated with life. IDK, if I played for a bunch of NL Central teams like that, maybe I would be too. I don't know.
That's a guy very, very happy that there's an NLDH because that's going to make him a lot of extra money that he wouldn't otherwise make in this country.
Last night had 2 very special moments for different reasons. I want to start with yours first, too, because you were inspired by the pitching performance, rightfully so, that you saw on the mound out of Braden Hughes.
Well, it was just so cool because when he came in the game, we saw people running down in the 100 level, running right down the stairs toward the field. And we're thinking that's got to be mom and dad and either wife or girlfriend. And it was, and they're holding up their phones. And it was just a little pure moment here. And it looked like parents at a 9U travel tournament. And, you know, that's the major leagues. And this guy's a converted outfielder. And I want to say it's the first time in Major League history a pitcher making his debut in the majors got 5 outs all on strikeouts.
Correct.
How cool is that? It was just neat.
It was, and that's one of those moments like from The Natural, and we'll get to that in a second, but it is one of those moments where you recognize your opportunity and you answer the call and you do it flawlessly, and that was really what happened there. When you get all 5 of those outs via strikeout, that's... What is there that's better for a pitcher?
Former outfielder.
Yeah, just recently converted. And then we wanted to watch the one other time through the order, see Happ and Suzuki, and they were like, all right, let's walk over to D'Agostino's and watch some NBA basketball. Let's see, we knew he'd catch the fourth quarter, and we knew we'd grab some fried mushrooms and some thin crust pizza and some fries and hang out. And then we missed the better moment, I think.
In the eighth inning, I believe, yeah, it was two outs. Cubs are up 6-0. And then Christopher Morel says he's going to do what Wilson Contreras did, and that's homer in his first ever major league plate appearance. And that ball was crushed.
And the 3-2. Swing and a drive. Deep left field. It's got a chance. Gone. Welcome to the Chicago Cubs, Christopher Morel. He missed first base. He goes back and steps on it. What a moment.
Can you believe it? Right? It's just one of them nights here at the Friendly Complex.
It really was like something out of a movie. And then to see him get to first base and he's already fired up and to circle the bases. And then when he goes back to the dugout and you see Wilson Contreras' emotion.
Oh, everybody, the whole dugout's going insane.
I really appreciated Wilson's emotion, though, in that moment, because we talk a lot about him being fired up, but we don't always talk about when he's happy for people, like he was with his brother exchanging the lineup card. And then we see that as well with Morel, and I think that speaks volumes.
Wasn't the TV call great, too?
Here's the 3-2. That is hammered. Left field. Oh, my goodness.
Why not?
This was great. Got a touch first. Christopher Morel.
Oh, my. You got to be kidding me.
His first major league at bat, he goes yard.
He goes Waveland.
Yard.
Yeah, the trajectory of that ball was NBA 3 worthy.
No doubter. And he said, apparently, he called it. Apparently told everybody, I'm going to do something here. I'm going to hit this out or something like that. And he's got the reputation of one of those guys that has stuff kind of follow him around.
Yeah, I saw that quote too. It was like in the seventh inning, and he wasn't in the lineup, and he pinch hit in the eighth, and he was just like, I'm going to hit a home run.
Yep.
And Wilson was like, are you hitting? He goes, no, but I'm ready.
And Wilson Contreras also did the same thing. He homered in his first at bat, maybe even the first pitch, when he came up as a Cub.
That's the first time a Cub has had a home run in his first plate appearance since Contreras in 2016.
Starlin Castro did it, if I remember correctly. And I want to say there was a pitch. Was it Jim Bullinger? Look that up. I believe Jim Bullinger, that's the guy that Terry used to joke about his giant ears, right? He used to say he got his ears pinned back. Or he used to like always make Dumbo jokes about him, though. But I want to say Jim Bullinger did that, too. I could be wrong.
You're correct.
Wow. And
against James Shields.
No! What? Wow. And the other one that I remember was being at the game as a reporter many years ago when the White Sox called up Carlos Lee, and he did the same thing.
Here it is. The all-time Cubs with a home run in their first plate appearance. There's 8 in franchise history. Oh. Morel, Contreras, Jorge Soler in 2014, Starlin Castro in 2010, Jim Bullinger in 1992, Kuno Barragan in 1961. And the list goes back to Enrogan Gillespie as well.
I misread that. It wasn't James Shields. I'm sorry. I ruined it.
Yeah, that can't be right. No, James Shields wasn't playing then.
Right, 1992. My fault.
I was like, wait a second.
Yeah, that couldn't be. Who?
Were you thinking of Bartolo Colon?
Maybe.
Now you got to find out who it was
so,
off of.
1992, June 8th against the Cardinals. So I'll find that out.
Okay, are you turning into TikTok baseball sleuth? Is that what's happening?
This is happening. You should see the tabs I have open on this computer right now.
Oh, I always have like 35 tabs open at one time. Like, I'm the worst about that.
The 312 says it was Jermaine Dye, not Carlos Lee. No, it was Carlos Lee. One has nothing to do with the other. One was many, many, many years before the other, like 10 years before, and I was there. I was covering the game. It was Carlos Lee.
Boom.
I think if I remember, it was that game or the other game that was like the longest I know Karkovice was catching, and I think it was the by time, the longest actual nine-inning game played up until that point. It's probably been broken 10 times since then. But it was like a four-hour and 48-minute nine-inning game. And I'll never forget that Rob Price was reporting for the Score. I think it was 95. And he picks up the phone, and they say, let's go to Rob Price with a report. And his lead was, if this game were a horse, somebody would have shot it.
Oh, my goodness.
And the whole press box cracked up. It was great. Everybody was completely miserable at that point. We have the Midday Midway coming up next. There is a new animated show coming to HBO that has some people connected to the project that are going to make it absolutely awesome. And for some of us out there who grew up with a certain kind of ethnic folktale, you're going to find this absolutely heartwarming, because if they can get this right, it's going to be fantastic.
There's a couple different stories, and I don't know which one I'm going to do yet. So free for all.
The first half or the second half, you know, they're two equal times.
Now, Midway.
The Midday Midway.
One, two.
Midway, the most important of the year.
Three, four.
The most exciting thing on the Midway.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Our objective is Midway.
9, 10.
You guys gotta meet me halfway out there.
So real, you can almost feel it.
The Midday Midway with Dan Bernstein on 670 The Score.
Time for the Midday Midway in the middle of your week. It is all downhill from here right into your weekend. So this starts the back half of your week, unofficially. We started out by, you don't have a normal work week. Do you have any days off ever?
Yeah. Sometimes I'm off both Friday and Saturday.
Sometimes.
I got to ask my boss about a thing they've asked me to do on a Friday coming up. I'll explain later if I get permission.
We started out by reviewing what happened after the White Sox doubleheader split when they dropped the nightcap, and Ozzie Guillen just said that something as simple as he wants the best players on the team to play both games, and he explained exactly why, and the starting shortstop for the White Sox took umbrage and tweeted at Ozzie, and there was a bit of a kerfuffle, and Ozzie, I thought, explained himself this morning on The Score with Mully and Haw in a very professional fashion, and I think everything will end up being fine. But the bottom line is, Ozzie's right. They got to play better, and if it means playing your best players in these games against lesser divisional opponents, do it. Win the damn games. World Series expectations. Let's go already.
We didn't even talk about Josh Harrison being sent, which I didn't even take issue with, because they had to get runs somehow.
And that guy can't throw. That's the other
thing.
They
disrespect Andrew Benintendi's
arm. They should.
They have before, openly, confidently.
His arms is terrible.
They have confident sends with him, or as I like to call him sometimes, Andrew Benintendo.
I would have said him too. Mike Florio talked football, and we also celebrated the Cubs.
I agree. That deserved one. And the Department of... I still don't know how this works. So Seth Green got hacked.
Uh-oh.
And the hackers took his NFTs.
His apes?
He paid a lot of money for the apes.
Oh,
the
no!
Ape doodles.
His apes are gone. They're not worth anything anymore.
The headline on the internet says, and this is what got me, Seth Green's apes gone, begs internet not to buy them. And I didn't know he had bought some of the ape NFTs. I thought maybe, I don't know, it's Seth Green. Who the heck knows? I watched that episode of Entourage with Nick Cannon, and I'm still thinking that that's real in some way, and am slightly happy he got hacked, even though it was just a fake episode of Entourage. Either way, his NFTs were stolen by a hacker of the apes, and he's asking people to not buy them. The Bored Ape was already sold for $200,000 by the hacker. So much for your theory
that
they're not worth anything. They are indeed. And the Mutant Ape was sold for $42,200. And the other two NFTs are worth a combined $70,000. Can't you spend it on something else?
Yeah, I doubt those numbers.
I mean, if it's sold, it's sold. If somebody paid that money for it, they pay that money.
I guess.
But do you want to believe the hacker is the thing?
There was a Twitter meme several weeks ago when somebody like invested their entire life savings in their apes, and the apes got stolen from them. And my apes, and everybody was just roasting the guy. I think Seth Green's probably diversified well enough that the apes were just maybe a little thing on the side.
That's probably his residuals from that Entourage episode, for all we know.
Right, just that episode, right?
It's a great episode. He gets in a fight, and they play Uncle Luke, and it makes me happy.
Not a lot of things. Seth Green, I mean, people know him as Scott from Austin Powers, but you start looking at, I mean, Robot Chicken, and he's on Family Guy, right? Isn't he the voice of Chris on Family Guy?
He's the voice of Chris on Family Guy?
Yeah.
True.
Yeah.
I'm today years old when I find this out.
And I believe when he was 6 or 7 years old, he's the kid from the Woody Allen movie Radio Days. I believe he plays the young sort of stand-in for the protagonist.
I was explaining the episode of Family Guy to a colleague yesterday, talking about the one where they have the line, "I haven't been this excited since my trip to Philadelphia," and then they get the announcement that the flight to Philly's been canceled, and they all cheer. It's about Jersey Mike's. Right. Yeah, that's a pretty epic Family Guy episode.
While we're talking about animated television shows, my sister just sent me this, and I texted back a question mark, and she said, "This is real." And if you grew up a certain way, you have heard the tales, the fables, one way or another, of the wise men of Helm. And Helm is a...
Helm?
Helm, C-H-E-L-M.
Anytime you can...
Helm, the wise men of Helm.
Helm.
And Helm is an actual city. I believe it's in Poland, but back when the borders didn't really matter as much for the Ashkenazi Jews, the Eastern European Jews, it's the Yiddish folk tales of Helm are something you grow up with as a very young child.
Go on.
And there are children's books and wonderful drawings and children's books. And they're silly stories translated from Yiddish. And famously, when they talk about the wise men of Helm and the rabbis in this town, everybody there is an idiot. It is a completely sarcastic Yiddish reference to wise people of Helm. And as the story goes, they say, when God created the world, so it is said, he sent out an angel with a bag of foolish souls with instructions to distribute them equally all over the world.
Two of them are in the studio.
But the angel's bag got snagged on a tree branch and broke. And all of the souls spilled out into the same spot. All of the fools of the world built a settlement, and that town was known as Helm. And those stories were a folktale tradition for those of us of Eastern European Jewish extraction. And it's very, very silly, but fun. Think children's book things.
Sure.
But the roots of a lot of that humor, a lot of that ancient humor, is what found its way into all of the rest of the way the Jewish humor has influenced modern humor, whether it has been through the Marx Brothers and Mel Brooks and everything else that has gone. And there have been many books written well.
I celebrate Mel's entire catalog.
HBO Max and Cartoon Network announced today that they are going to make a family-oriented animated special for younger audiences called Helm, the Smartest Place on Earth. Your team will involve Sacha Baron Cohen and the team of Mike Judge, Greg Daniels, and Michael Koeman.
Heck yeah!
Yep, Mike Judge, you know, of Beavis and Butthead and King of the Hill. Greg Daniels, also King of the Hill. Michael Koeman from Saturday Night Live. And the narrator will be Sacha Baron Cohen. It is set in the mythical town of Fools. It is explained in their press release. It will share the absurdist humor and interpretive questioning, a fresh take on the silly antics and exaggerated conflicts of the town while preserving the essence and the heart of the classic folktales. And according to Amy Friedman, the head of kids and family programming at Warner Brothers, she said, "This pitch was so hilarious, we knew the HBO Max audience needed to get a dose of this original brand of storytelling." So this is fabulous to have this all-star team involved in continuing this tradition. And I am 100% confident that it will be more than done justice by this crew.
It sounds like fun. Greg Daniels' whole resume is pretty great.
Yep.
The Office, for example. He has Simpsons credits.
Yep.
Very exciting.
Very exciting. And there, I can't, there's any number of versions of these famous tales. And I know that they will, this will be the best version yet.
Also, I love everybody on the text line chiming in with the Seth Green resume.
Yes, crazy,
Seth Green,
right?
IMDb just happened on the text line. Can't hardly wait. Oz on Buffy TV show. Don't forget Seth Green was in Idle Hands. Great stoner horror comedy. And let's not forget he was Special K in the movie Can't Hardly Wait. Seth Green was also in the original Stephen King's It. And my favorite, yes. Tell Sloan I Said What's Up, Seth Green to E. He was like hitting on his girlfriend via E. And E got fired. You just have to see the episode.
I think I did. I just didn't retain it.
I don't know why I like it so much. I just do.
We like Steve Stone, too. And there's a lot to talk about in the world of the White Sox. He'll join us next on The Score.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.